Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRue Show. This is Marcia Mary Baker. It's Saturday, December 18th, 2010. And our topic is Sudan is a Nation, Not a British Zoo, Where We Stand in the War for National Sovereignty. Our focus today will be on Africa, not just Sudan, but other parts and developments in that continent. And I want to stress right at the outset, as I introduce our guests, two guests on this panel, that our purpose in all of this is to reach and re-up citizens everywhere, especially in the United States right now, to defeat the dying imperial system, the British Empire, because this is no holiday season, and put it this way, it's also no post-election season in the United States. It's no time for any kind of funk, because we have an incomparable situation of collapse, but we also have an incomparable opportunity. Now, our guests will be saying more on that, but our agenda as this year comes to an end is more than ever, it's do or die for the Glass-Steagall approach to putting an end to this expiring imperialist monetarist system and creating the situation to rebuild the world on every continent, to collaborate in doing that among nations, especially the main four powers, and to and also to take emergency intervention in the United States as states and localities, namely the country, shuts down for only for the reason of lack of leadership and for the continuation of these kind of imperial insane policies. So enough on the introduction. I want to welcome on both sides of the Atlantic. I'll begin with my side of the shores in Baltimore. We're welcoming Lawrence Freeman. Welcome, Larry.
Great to be with you.
And Larry, for some time, has been the Africa desk for EIR, spending time visiting in Sudan, visiting in Nigeria. And I welcome from the eastern side of the Atlantic, from Paris, Christine Bière. Welcome, Christine.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, and I'm glad to have you be able to have both of you on at the same time. Christine was just on a delegation to Africa, to Niger, that was about a week ago, right, Christine?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To celebrate the commemoration of the founding of that nation, its birthday, and she was with Jacques Cheminade, who is the founder and presidential candidate for the Solidarity and Progress Party in France, and Christine is the editor. In fact, she's, I think, at her editing post tonight, putting to bed the French periodical, comes out about every 2 weeks, I believe, New Solidarity.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, New Solidarity. Nouvelle Solidarité.
Thank you. And, you know, I'll just say right here at the beginning that I mentioned Larry's been in Nigeria, a special touch with that nation. Nigeria, as well as Niger, as well as 16 other nations, have their 50th anniversary of their founding in 2010. And I think that's the backdrop to look at how the continuation of the British Empire policies under various guises has, well, we'll get to that when we discuss Africa, caused misery. But what I want to do is get to the continent of Africa via a short detour of a situation report on the transatlantic geopolitical region, namely what's going on, without going into details, in Washington and Europe, or you could say the Eurozone, that because over the last week, hour by hour, in this part of the world, we have many events, many of which have been miserable. Congress, which was a lame duck Congress, turned into a kind of dead duck Congress by the end of the week, voting up some miserable compromise between the City of London, Wall Street, the White House, Obama, and the kind of Pelosi and other elements of Congress, the no-good so-called tax, whatever you want to call it, bill. The Irish government last Wednesday voted to okay what amounts to looting of its people in the name of a bailout to banks. But, of course, that government is not long. It's a dead duck government, too, not long to stay in power. And we have other developments because this trillions of dollars or euros or whatever you want to denominate it in, of rotten bad debt, is at the collapse point. Butch, on the other hand, is a break point, a chance for the world that we set it aside and go ahead with what I mentioned before, establishing a real credit system, stable currencies, and the Glass-Steagall approach. So before we get to Africa, Christine from Paris, would you just describe the kind of mood of rebellion or any other aspects of the political scene from Europe, especially that Americans will find very important to know right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, what is significant is that populations are in a complete revolt against this euro system. We find this very directly in the work that we are doing now in France with the mayors. You know that in order to be a presidential candidate, Jacques Cheminade must be presented as a candidate by more than 500 mayors. And in this context, we're calling mayors throughout the country, and we find really a hatred, not only against the Paris elites, but very much against the euro, for instance. And then you have a situation which is even more interesting in Germany, because there is not only the population who wants to go back to the Deutschmark, but it's a whole section of the elite who obviously also would like to go back to the Deutschmark. And there is obviously a huge battle in that country between those who want to stay and those who want out. But what is happening is that at the level of governments, they are still clinging on to this euro system, even though bankruptcy is all over the place. You have two factions. You have the continental Europeans who are in power now, Sarkozy, Merkel, and the others, who are trying to still save this euro system and trying to limit the bailouts so that they're going to extend in order to save it. While you have the British factions, which are all out trying to really get from the continental Europeans a massive, massive bailout of their own bankrupt banks. And from the official voices, very little people are raising the need to just, completely call it off to go for the Glass-Steagall reorganization and to go back to the approach of de Gaulle and Adenauer, which was not a supranational financier approach, but it was a Europe of the nations based on industry, on agricultural development, and on real physical production.
Okay, good. That's both. It's heartening, and it's also, it recalls us that we have to act as citizens here instead of people. Lyndon LaRouche issued call to arms in the last 2 years at key moments before the November elections in the U.S., after the elections, and so forth. So it's certainly do or die now, but we're glad to hear what you say. Well, with that, let's go to Africa. I mentioned about the 18 nations, Larry, that this year commemorate their 50th anniversary of origin. But in fact, Sudan was, its nationhood began in the 1950s. But its very nationhood is now at stake with these wild interventions against and so forth. Would you just begin the discussion?
Well, unfortunately, it's sad to say that in the 50 years that many African countries celebrated their independence, the situation in many cases, has not only not improved, but the case can be made that conditions are worse off for hundreds of millions of Africans since independence. Sudan established its independence in 1956. In 24 days, on January 9th, 2011, there's going to be a referendum, a vote, to divide the largest country in Africa, the Sudan, into two separate countries, essentially to create a new state in Africa, a southern Sudan state. And this is absolutely wrong and should not occur, even though the consensus is that it will occur, although it's not 100% definite by any means at this point. Contrary to what people hear, this is not a vote for the liberation of southern Sudan, the people of southern Sudan. This is not a vote for the so-called Africans of southern Sudan to free themselves from the so-called Muslims of northern Sudan. This is a clear British imperial operation by the British financial empire, which goes back about 200 years in Sudan. And the purpose is to prevent the Sudan from becoming a sovereign nation, a nation that could provide stability and peace to the greater Horn of Africa and beyond. This referendum, which is hailed by our U.S. president and by various phony advocacy groups and the U.S. Congress, is not a positive development. It's actually intended to destabilize Sudan and Africa as a whole. The British, as people may know, if they've ever dealt with them, are not bashful about expressing their racism towards Africa. They do not see Africans as human beings. They do not see African nations as real institutions of government. Their view is to manipulate Africans as you would manipulate different species or control different species of animals in a zoo. That is literally how they view Africans. They have not only fostered competing so-called ethnic, religious, geographical groups, but they've actually created them when necessary. And they use these pseudo-identities they give to the ethnic, religious, or geographical distinctions, and then they use these pseudo-identities to manipulate them in divide and conquer against each other and against the nation, playing on the principles of the immediate pleasure and pain of each competing group. It should be understood by everybody that all of the people of Sudan are Sudanese, no matter what lineage they came from. Just like in the United States, we are all Americans, no matter where we came from. And this attempt to constantly force a discussion in Sudan and in all African countries around distinctions of the lineage of one group or one ethnicity against another is itself one of the major crimes left over from the legacy of the British colonial period. That the British imperialists do not accept the idea that Africans can govern themselves. They oppose the very idea. And they oppose any potential to develop institutions of national government in Africa. Now, the conflict in Sudan right now, despite many ignorant people who have refused to look at this, this started by the British. This is not something that we're making, it's not an allegorical statement. In 1925, the British who ruled Sudan created laws, created what's called the Passport and Ordnance Act. These laws actually physically, legally, according to British law, divided the country into two halves, north and south, and made it a criminal act for a northerner to pass into the south. And they kept the south backward. They kept the south backward precisely to create a two separate entities, a north and a south, that would fight each other. Now, they did this in other countries in Africa. So even before Sudan achieved independence from the British in 1956, in 1955, there was already wars going on between the north and the south. And the south, as I say, was kept as a backward portion of the country with no development. And people at various times were forced not to wear modern clothing, but to wear the most primitive tribal clothing to build up and instill this identity, tribal identity in them. This is the British policy. We've seen it in Nigeria. We've seen it in Kenya. We've seen it through the whole continent. This idea of treating Africa as a zoo. And this is also the same policy they've had towards Darfur, where they've created groups that didn't exist so they could actually create destabilizations in Darfur. Now, this is the British policy. Unfortunately, the U.S. is playing a bad role because we've accepted for the moment, and we hope to change it, this British policy, because we have a British faction in the United States government. We have the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, who's leading this British faction. She herself is a committed ideologue of British imperial policies for Africa. and she always has been. As a result of her taking the helm on this thing for approximately two decades, the United States, essentially from 1993 to 2010, has adopted an anti-Sudan policy. We've adopted a policy for regime change, that is to overthrow the president, al-Bashir, who took power in a bloodless coup in 1989, and to overthrow his party, the National Congress Party. And we saw this under the Clinton administration, the two Bush administrations, and now under the Obama administration have stuck to this policy with Susan Rice as the leader of this policy. Now, this, the policy to divide up Sudan, is not an American policy. This has nothing to do with what America stands for and America believes, and anything to do with the history of our country and our culture. But nevertheless, we have adopted it, this divide-and-conquer policy of the British. The roots of this, in the modern period, go back to the 1970s, when we had Henry Kissinger taking the lead on writing this report, National Security Study Memorandum 200, 1974 to 1976, which essentially became the official policy of the United States and became a policy of genocide toward Africa by the West, which said, essentially, we need all the valuable minerals and natural resources of African and other developing sector countries. And therefore, we oppose population growth and we oppose industrial development because that would use up these resources, which we depend on an uninterrupted supply for the maintenance of our countries. So this policy really was the official policy, although it was unofficial. And what we saw explicitly, whatever developments took place from the Roosevelt period into the Kennedy period, by the 1970s, all long-term infrastructure development in Africa by the West and by the United States had come to a halt. And as I've instructed many people over the recent period, if you look at the deficit in infrastructure, as a colonial policy, as a policy of this National Security Memorandum 200, and you look at the creation and fostering of these ethnic identities, these two policies have done more to destroy Africa. And in fact, every conflict that you look at in Africa today, you can derive from the continuation of these two policies. Now we have this vote on January 9th, 2011. This vote came about as a what's called a part of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement called the CPA. The CPA was signed by the North and the South in January 2005. And as part of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, it was stipulated that there be a referendum in 6 years for the people of the South to vote if they wanted to stay with the current Sudan government or create their own state. Now, this itself is unacceptable and was wrong. And we never accepted that in the United States. And if you read President Lincoln's second inaugural address, he made very clear to what extent he would go to prevent the destruction of our union. What happened was when Bush came into power in 2001, he essentially was forced or lobbied very heavily by the so-called Christian and evangelical crowd. In particular, Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, put a lot of pressure on the Bush administration. Bush, being mentally deficient, was easily susceptible to pressure. And they made some kind of credible threat to the government President Bashir and forced them to begin this process of negotiating with the South. Now, we missed a great opportunity then because the government of President Bashir had broken from the hardcore militant factions of the Muslim Brotherhood, represented by Hassan al-Tarabi, and therefore was open for development and collaboration on development of Sudan. We forced this comprehensive peace process on him. And it was forced by the West that there must be a referendum. The Sudanese opposed it. They were told, you must accept this. And so they accepted the referendum. And all during this period, no matter what was done by the government of Sudan, the United States continued and increased its sanctions and its harsh treatment of Sudan. And during this period where we should have been developing Sudan and uniting North and South together in infrastructure projects such as North-South railroads, in more water development projects, in supporting agriculture, which, as you know, Marsha, that Sudan, the studies were done years ago, that Sudan has the agricultural potential to feed all of southern of sub-Saharan Africa, 600 million people. Nothing, not only was nothing done, but through sanctions and other means, the Susan Rice policy and others, financial policy of the British, kept driving Sudan further and further into poverty. So there was no development of the country. So the people in the south who lived terribly, absolutely terribly, was one of the poorest regions in the world, blame the north, blame the government of Sudan, but the conditions were forced upon them by a lack of American policy to actually develop the country. So the CPA is an artificial operation, and it forced them to make decisions that are actually detrimental to the country in having this vote. But nevertheless, it looks like this vote is going to happen. And we have to realize at this point that there's another feature to the separation process, which is very dangerous, which is that they have to secure a border between the northern and southern Sudan, which is 2,100 kilometers, which is very difficult. This is no man's land in part of these areas. One of the areas, called Abyei, is a very volatile issue. It's not oil, as many people think. It is actually continuation of this colonial, ethnic, geographical destabilization. And they've been unable to resolve this problem. There was supposed to be a separate referendum on Abyei on January 9th. That is now off the table. And there's no resolution to the problem at the moment. And that everybody realizes that this can become a, this will become a sore, a cancer that will be used for further destabilizations inside Sudan. There are others, but this is probably the main one that can be used. The inability of the United States to approach Sudan is made worse by our stupid President Obama, because he basically gave in, again, through the Susan Rice and Company, to supporting the International Criminal Court, even though we have not joined it. So we said that, therefore, the attacks on the International Criminal Court against the President Bashir for an arrest warrant for crimes alleging genocide, we now instructed all our diplomats for years that they cannot talk to the President of Sudan. So here you have the President of Sudan, Bashir, who's one of the signers of the treaty and has to make all the decisions for a peaceful process in Sudan, and no U.S. citizen or U.S. diplomat is actually ever allowed to talk to him. So this shows you that really the United States is not helping in the interest of Sudan at this point. And in fact, they're not going to help Southern Sudan at all. So Southern Sudan is being misled to think that conditions are actually going to get better. Now, Lyndon LaRouche and our organization, we have made very clear in circles in Khartoum, in fact, all of Sudan and in the United States, that we support the sovereignty of Sudan and that we are an enemy of these British imperial policies. We are the American faction, so to speak, that is fighting inside the office of the presidency against the policies of manipulation under the British zoo scenarios or British zoo orientation that they have to Africa. But the failure of the West to promote a policy of development and the failure of the United States to be the leader in that is a major crime that has occurred since the adoption of the National Security Memorandum 200. And therefore, we are responsible for the conditions in southern Sudan and throughout all of Sudan. And as a result, this vote on January 9th, 2011, which if it comes off, and many people think that the South will vote for separation, this will create a permanent destabilization inside Sudan and Africa. A permanent, contentious, if not violent conditions that could lead to war once again. The southern Sudanese will not be rewarded for this. They will not get the economic help needed to improve their economy. We're in a collapsing, melting down of the financial system. The United States government itself is incapable of governing our own country. And so, therefore, there's not going to be any improvement in the conditions in Sudan from the West. And, in fact, these conditions of southern Sudan will be used to destabilize the entire country and to continue the policies of regime change towards the North. Obama, our president, has no concern for the welfare of the Sudanese, or does he have any concern for the welfare of any Africans. This should not be a surprise to us, because he has no concern for us Americans either. But the United States should be providing leadership. And Americans, we know now that we get no leadership from our Congress and our president. There's no mission, there's no vision of a future by any leadership in the United States. That is why the LaRouche PAC and Lyndon LaRouche are promoting this mission of NWAPA and recruiting and building leadership in the United States. For Africa, there is also no vision. There is no vision for Sudan past January 9, 2011. And I must say, I personally oppose this referendum, and I oppose the division of any African country. But we're not going to change Africa from Africa. We're not going to change Africa without a change in U.S. policy. That is the responsibility of the LaRouche Political Action Committee. We must provide the future for Africa as we recruit and build a leadership for the future of the United States through the announcement of our congressional candidates and the work of the LaRouche Political Action Committee website. That's the only hope that Africa has, is that we make a breakthrough in the United States, and therefore Africa's future is in our hands as well as our future in America. So I think that gives a complete summary of where things stand at the moment.
Yes, Larry, absolutely it does. And I'll say one thing now and then repeat it again before the show is over, because some of the people who listen by telephone message line should know. Larry Freeman, who just gave this briefing on the situation and the countdown to this attempted British dismemberment of Sudan, is going to be on Monday, that is the 20th of December, on radio in Washington, D.C., which you can listen anywhere in the world by webcast. He's going to be on with the Sudanese ambassador to the United States, Ambassador Ali from the Embassy of Sudan in Washington, D.C. So it's 10 a.m. Eastern Time for an hour, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., and you find it on www.wpfw.org. That's the radio call letters, which are WP as in Peter, F as in Fred, W. WPFW.org. As I say, I'll repeat it later. So there's more to discuss, but I want to turn to Christine, because your trip to participate in the commemoration in Niger of the founding of that nation, and you were there along with Jacques Cheminade, I mentioned, and so forth, is really a counter-intervention against this entire legacy and these dirty operations of the British Imperial Monitress Gang right now, right?
Absolutely.
Would you go into that, please?
Yes, because in fact, what we are trying, what this delegation was all about, is we were invited to participate in the commemorations of the 50th anniversary of the independence. And it's not only the creation of a nation, but it's, you know, it's getting out of before
right.
Niger was a French colony, and then they gained their independence. And we went there with the Lake Chad project for revitalizing the Lake Chad, which is a project which will, on the contrary, unite people, because it's going to give the central part of Africa where the Lake Chad is. If our project goes through, then this would create a whole center of production and of economic development in Central Africa, reaching out to about 50 million people, which are the ones which are concerned by the larger Lake Chad Basin. And thereby creating, as I said, the conditions for, you know, Pan-African, as I said, unity, as I said, which they have, the Africans have always been fighting for, as I said, since independence.
And you participated, that was presented, but you also have private discussions and so forth.
Yes, we were, in fact, the celebrations, which had been organized by a former cultural minister, Mr. Useni, Inusa Useni, who is currently the Niger ambassador to UNESCO in Paris, were very ambitious. They went from the 30th of November, and they're only finishing on the 18th of December.
Today.
And this involved many things, like, you know, film projections from, you know, films talking about the fights for independence, conferences like an international symposium, which is the one where Jacques Cheminade presented this Lake Chad project perspective, to, you know, different, they had a book fair, where a French print, a French editor, who, you know, gives the possibility to African authors to publish their ideas. They brought 20,000 books at near production cost, which when they were then sold there at this at these events, and many things of this sort. And so it was a big celebration. In the beginning, they thought of canceling it, but the ambassador thought it was very important to give a new perspective, a new sense of mission to the population to maintain it. And therefore, it was, you know, the whole tone was rather combative. And what was, I mean, what resumes, you know, a little bit what we were doing there is what happened at this international symposium, where there were essentially two main speeches. The first one was given by the Mrs. Law, who is the Niger representative to the United Nations Development Program, and whose speech was on 50 years after the independence, what has happened, and what will be the next challenge for the next 50 years. And what she said was, she was, you know, said these independences had been really a failure, because at the time of the independence, the Asian countries like China, Vietnam, and others, and Africa were at a par, more or less. And if you look now what has happened, the Asian countries have picked up massively. They have become what she referred to as a voice in the international community. While in Africa, as well, you have this Sudan situation, which Larry was just mentioning. But then you have elsewhere, you know, too many children dying of hunger, too many people has not scholarized. In Niger itself, you have 70% of the population which is illiterate, which is completely outrageous, even for, you know, a lesser developed country. So basically, she said the next 50 years must be those for the African giant who will finally, you know, awaken. And this presentation was then followed by that of Jacques Cheminade, who, you know, indicated why the world is in this crisis. It's not only Africa, but it's the entire world because of the looting policies of the monetarist empire based in the City of London and with its Wall Street and other appendices in the world. You know, called for the Glass-Steagall policies and then outlined, you know, the greater Lake Chad project, the Transaqua project, as a living project which would be able not only to refill the lake, but also to change the biosphere and, you know, allow for a real going back of the desert, pushing back of the desert, and real development for the whole continent.
Right, thanks. And let's, if we could go into this just a bit more, if either of you want to, let me ask you, the geoengineering, you mentioned pushing back the desertness.
Yes.
We remind listeners here that I think if you visualize on your map, in your mind, the map of the whole continent, most people can visualize the Nile. It's famous, it's legendary. So it's this, I think but the Niger River is the third longest, I think, on the continent.
Uh-huh.
And Larry, let me just put this physical side of things in terms of food. I know that you were at an event in Washington, D.C. recently where the foreign minister from Nigeria raised food as a key issue. If anyone wants to talk about democracy, the way these false friends of nations like to blab about, but there's no literacy or so forth and so on. But in Nigeria, you have a food crisis, which shouldn't be. It was once a food exporter. In Niger, I understand, Christine, I looked up in August. August was the month in 1960 where Niger had its official independence. And yes. I see that this past August, General Salu Djibou said that one of the biggest issues now for 14 million people in Niger is food. 3 to 5 million or more don't have enough food. Mm-hmm. So would either of you comment about the projects, the lack, you know what I mean, this food situation?
Well, go ahead, Christine.
Well, the situation there in Niger, they have had a couple of very important famines. One in 1974 is a very famous one because many people died. And the thing is that the Niger is drying up a little bit, not in the proportion of the Lake Chad, but nonetheless, the desert, you know, you can see is winning room in the country, and obviously it's one of, you know, a tremendously poor country, in spite of the fact that they have uranium, they have gold, they have, but especially uranium, which is being extracted by the Areva. The Areva company gets 40% of its uranium from there. But obviously until now they have not offered this country the right conditions for their uranium, and the country is, you know, still very poor. Now, this has a little bit changed since the Chinese have come in and are working on the oil, and that gave maneuvering room to Niger to renegotiate the contracts with Areva in better conditions. So they're getting more money. They're able to commercialize part of the extraction of uranium, and that would be the, you know, a little bit the way to go in the next period of time, even though it's not a solution to the present crisis. But indeed, the country is very, very, very poor.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you take the issue of food, look, there is no valid reason that African countries can't feed themselves today. You had in the 1950s and 60s when the majority of African nations became independent, they were food sufficient. They could feed their people. And now you look at the condition 30 years later, 40 years later, why do we have this problem? There's no rational reason for it except the actual policies of this monetarist thinking, which is implemented by the World Trade Organization, which should be another organization that dissolves itself for the sake of humanity. Their policies have stipulated that nations are not allowed to build up and support their own agriculture to feed their own people, which is insane. You add that to the problem of the lack of infrastructure, where even food produced cannot be transported inside one's country for the benefit of its people. And then you look at the water problem the way Christine is presenting it. Africa actually has a lot of water. It's just, as in the case of the United States, as we made the relevant points in our NWAPA presentations, the water doesn't exist in the same level in the same parts of the continent, but there's a lot of water. So the idea that you should take water from the Congo River Basin, where the Congo is one of the most water-rich areas on the continent, not the only one, and move it over to a dry basin, in the Lake Chad Basin, this is basic thinking. This is what normal thinking governments would do, but they need to be helped to do it. And the fact that we don't do things like that, and the fact that we kill Africans by refusing to allow them to develop their own agricultural policies, this is what is destroying the people of Africa today. And they're not a problem of objective conditions. They're not a problem of limitations of Africans. They are a problem of policies coming from this geopolitical thinking of the British, what I call the British zoo crowd. This is what is causing this, and this is why we have to eliminate this grouping, this policy grouping, from controlling resources on this planet and return them back to a rational scientific policy governed by nation states.
Well, Christine, let me ask you, if you want to say anything about the reaction people had. You mentioned Jacques Cheminade's presentation of who the culprits are here, the present-day crisis, who's behind it. And did you get, say, can you generalize about private response to the British, French, whatever form, whatever branch of colonialism legacy you want to talk about? But what did people pick up on this especially?
We didn't get so many reactions. However, what was very interesting were the reactions to the Lake Chad project.
Oh, okay, good.
In particular, because we found people. First of all, Jack was able to really brief a lot of people and go right at the grouping who is now heading the country, because he was introduced, you know, to practically the whole government. We had a meeting with the Prime Minister's office, with the Prime Minister himself, and we had the chance also to meet with the governor of one of the eight departments of the country, Colonel Bagadoma, who is a young colonel who was here in the war college in Paris, and there presented his memoir at the end on the smaller Transaqua project, the one which is aiming at getting water from the Ubangi Logon basin to bring it to the Shari and into the Lake Chad. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, there is a renewed interest overall in this project. Recently, there was the latest summit of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, which was created in 1964 in N'Djamena, in Chad. Mm-hmm. And this is a commission where you have the six main countries concerned by the Lake Chad are part of this. It's Chad, Cameroon, Niger, Central African Republic, and Libya. And these countries met, and they decided also to extend a $6 million a credit for feasibility studies on this smaller Lake Chad project, the smaller, what they call it, Transaqua. It's not really a Transaqua, but it's a smaller version. Mm-hmm. So there's renewed interest, and they have this colonel who's interested in the project as well in Niger. And the thing is to get them to see that while this project is minimal, we should go for the bigger project. So we can start with a smaller project, but we must absolutely have the larger project, which is the Viki project, which was presented by a company called Bonifica back in the early 80s, in 1982, and which is aimed, as Larry was saying, the aim was to take 5% of the water from the Congo, which otherwise just goes into the sea, and create a huge navigable canal from Kivu going to the Shari and then filling up the lake. But in reality, it's like a living. It's a different project from the previous one, because this project is like a living creature which will change as it goes from the Kivu to the lake, because a navigable canal will then be used for irrigation as it goes, and creating a whole greening this area and opening up to real production. And so that's the whole difference. And around this, then, you know, textile industries, different industries can start, and trade can develop among these all these countries. So basically, it was the idea to give them a sense that they have to think big, because also in the advanced sector, you know, they're trying to reduce their project, and they have to go back to these years in the 70s and 80s, which we call here in Europe the 30 glorious years, where people were thinking big, where these companies were thinking of continental projects. involving not only rivers and canals, but also highways, transcontinental highways, to intersect that canal. Because the idea was to really, you know, develop the entire continent. And they have to go back thinking big. And obviously, the role of France, you know, if it wants to completely abandon any role it had in the continent as a kind of junior partner to the British, the role of France is to help these countries, to give them the means where they can develop this kind of project. And Jacques used the Gaulle's phrase back in when immediately after the war. That's when the Gaulle first started, you know, trying to lay the grounds for an end to colonialism, and he gave this very well-known speech in Brazzaville on January 30th, 1944, where he said, "We must open the road for new times." And you know, and obviously at that time he was thinking of getting the African elites to go towards a kind of self-rule, but within the context of a French community. Later he changed, and you know, we, what we mean by new times is much, much, much more. But that's the message that Jacques brought down to Niger in this trip.
Well, thank you. And in the remaining few minutes, there's two things. One thing, an email has come in from Eastern Pennsylvania that's querying about some of the evil networks. In other words, there's deployment of the Muslim Brotherhood in Sudan. There's a question about that as it relates to the imperial designs, Larry. Also, I'll just throw in here a question that came in advance. The scope of this massive deployment against Sudan includes such things as, in recent weeks, this George Clooney Hollywood operation, where he was made a UN messenger of peace and created a group called Not On Our Watch in 2007. It's all part of the British capability, the imperial capability that you just described, right? Do you want to say something about this?
Well, take the latter point first on the question of what's been done recently. I mean, I know nothing about George Clooney's beliefs, except he has been recruited to be part of this alliance. He's particularly being run by a guy named John Prendergast, who has created this organization called the Enough Organization, which originally came out of the Center for American Progress, supported by George Soros. He was also active. He was recruited by Susan Rice in the early 90s to join her, I believe it was at the National Security Council, and later on, I think in either the first or second Clinton administration, himself and Susan Rice and a fellow by the name of Anthony Lake became the troika for regime change in Sudan and were behind the bombing of the pharmaceutical plant. So Clooney, whether he knows it or not, has essentially been captured to be part of this. And the media extravaganza around him is extremely aimed to provoke the North. I watched part of it a couple of weeks ago, and it's provocative. It's designed to whip up southern Sudan against the North, as does Susan Ambassador Rice when she travels to southern Sudan, actually conduct what are called undiplomatic or otherwise over-the-top pep rallies for the South to separate from the North. Hardly what a diplomat would be expected to do. So it's a very clear top-down operation. This comes out of the Save Darfur crowd, which basically raised $30 million over several years, and almost none of it that we could tell when we went to Darfur in April last year, none of that money ever reached the people of Darfur. The problem is that whatever the well-meaning supporters do or believe, the people at the top have no concern for the welfare of the Sudanese or any Africans who are living in hellish conditions in Darfur or southern Sudan. They don't really give a damn, to be impolite, about it. And it's and they're using people to promote their cause. The overall situation in Sudan, as the email person sent the email suggested, it's a problem because all of Africa was run by colonial powers. And the British were the dominant ones. So Sudan has a whole history attached to the Muslim Brotherhood. They've got all kinds of operations, as I mentioned, that the British ran. Sudan, don't forget, was one of the few countries that successfully kicked the British out. In 1885, the Mahdi created the Islamic State when they drove the British out of Khartoum with the famous story in Chinese Gordon lost his head over that
right.
battle.
Mm-hmm.
And they ruled Sudan for 13 years, 1885 to 1898. They actually had an independent state. It was run under principles associated and beliefs in Islam, but it was an independent state. And then in 1898, after Kitchener came down and various geopolitical manipulations backed down the French in Fashoda, he raised down the Nile to actually wipe out the followers of the Mahdi, about 25,000 of them, and retake Khartoum for British colonial policy. Now, the importance of that was whoever controlled Sudan controlled the Nile River system. And then they said to the French, well, you guys can have whatever to the west of it. And that's how the French got Chad. Although there's no reason, there's no difference between Chad and Darfur and the Central African Republic. They're all the same rotten, desolate desert conditions. But this is the way the colonials divided it up. So there's a very strong nationalist, patriotic current in Sudan. There is a Muslim current in Sudan, but it wasn't always Muslim. At one point, it was Christian. So, and there's all kinds of British manipulations, including the Muslim Brotherhood, which the current ruling president and followers in the National Congress Party broke from al-Turabi. It was a very painful decision because Turabi had been a leader at one point, but Turabi had an idea of a greater Islamic state in Africa, which they rejected. So rather than taking advantages of that rejection of Turabi and promoting policies for development that would unite the North and the South, the Americans and the British in particular went ahead and said, no, now is our chance to increase the divisions so that we have a permanent destabilization in this huge country with this huge important water system as a foothold to continue to destabilize most of Africa. And that is something that we've got to put an end to.
Maybe I can still bring something relative to what Larry is saying.
Yes, please, Christine. Go ahead.
This British mentality, this dividing up people into ethnic communities, this pitting one against the other. You see, this is completely ridiculous, because as you get to Niger, for instance, in Niger we were able to visit the National Museum. And they bring you to see these replicas of the beautiful prehistoric paintings and engravings of the Sahara and also of the Niger region, which go back to the Neolithic. And you see these beautiful representations of animals, of giraffes, for instance, in a very, very aesthetic way. And immediately next to these reproductions at the museum, there was an oven for extraction of copper, terracotta oven where you mm-hmm. heat up and you extract copper.
Wow.
And so you see, you go there and you think you're going to go to a very, very, very different place from, the transatlantic countries. And in fact, you come there and you find out that in the Neolithic they were doing these beautiful things and that they're completely universal to the human beings. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the exciting thing, is to see that across these countries, across these continents, there's one human being, and his concept, its creativity is consubstantial to all human beings, and that's what we have to build upon.
Right. And Larry, on the theme Christine raised about across, you were talking about across time and across continents and so forth, but you reminded us when you were in Darfur and so forth, I mean, the whole possibility of creating the expanded, new, new replenished Lake Chad Basin has immediate effects. It strikes a blow against the entire legacy of imperialism, but it would have immediate concrete effects. You want to say something about that in the way that it's perfectly clear about water and Darfur being the future?
Well, I think one thing, just in terms of the Lake Chad project that Christine developed, the Democratic Republic of the Congo is, again, one of the poorest nations. It's also the most, I came up with this phrase, deficit deficient. That is, the amount of kilometers per person in the Congo, I believe, could be the lowest in the world, but certainly the lowest on the African continent. And they have the culture has been destroyed by genocide against the people of the Congo, at least twice that we know of. So this Lake Chad project also is very important for the Congo because we have to interject some optimism and some scientific optimism of how you could bring in infrastructure and change the downward direction that the Democratic Republic of Congo has been under to actually build up another portion of Africa through this canal that Christine was talking about. This kind of optimism is very important for the people of the Congo. But the whole question of water is so central to Africa, as we now are understanding it's central to the United States through NWAPA and other NWAPA-related projects. The people who complain about Darfur, I have to use more diplomatic language on the phone, but they have no concern at all for Darfur because the problem in Darfur is the lack of water. As it is the problem in Chad, in Niger, all these places. There's no water. There's no transportation. These people live out on the fringes of human existence. And this is the problem. Why have we not gone ahead with water development, at least starting with the sandstone aquifer, which we could at least bring up some water from, but moving, using desalination, which is necessary for building up the equivalent of a second Nile. There's only 84 billion cubic meters in the Nile, which is not enough to take care of several hundred million people. So when Mr. LaRouche was in Khartoum in 2001, January, at a conference on development of the Nile, he said, well, we need a new Nile. And this shocked everyone. We said, we got to create the equivalent of a new Nile. How do we do that? By using nuclear-powered desalination from the Mediterranean. And then you create an equivalent amount of water. This injection of what I call scientific optimism is so essential for the countries of Africa who don't see any hope or any future. There is a proposal by the Organization of Islamic Countries for an East-West Railroad, which the French wanted back in the 1890s in their fight with the British, would run from Port Sudan all the way across to Dakar. And this would revolutionize Chad, Niger, Nigeria, Sudan, Ethiopia, and then going to the western part. These kinds of projects, which people say are too big, too expensive, you'll never see them in Africa, they are absolutely essential for Africa. And if we get NWAPA going in the United States, we got a foothold to develop these projects, which are so essential to reverse the morality decline in the culture that Africa has suffered for so long.
Right. Well, we're down to the final maybe almost 60 seconds or more, but I just want to throw in here that people should know that the reality that you've presented, both the absolute horrors, but on the other hand, the opportunity here, certainly is kind of gives us the grounds to have optimism on principle instead of all the it's hopeless, there's nothing you can do, and it's just misery. I'm going to repeat that on Monday, that's the 20th of December from 10 to 11 in the morning Eastern Time, if you want to hear the Sudanese ambassador to the United States, Ambassador Ali, and also Larry Freeman again, whom you've just been hearing. This is the website. It's on the radio called WPFW, therefore you go www.wpfw.org. And I'm going to tell everyone in advance, our guests will give me forbearance here, that Christmas Day and New Year's Day are the next two Saturdays we have before us, and we are not going to do any reruns here on the LaRouche Show, not at this critical time in history. Nothing stale and tired. We'll have special tapings by Harley Schlanger that will relate to the tasks we have before us, and also we will be hearing some special lessons of history about the real origins of the first and original Tea Party in Boston. Actually, was also in Philadelphia, Annapolis, and elsewhere, and because December 16th, 2 days ago, was the celebration of that here in the United States. So we're going to have those special shows. So I'm afraid that takes our time, but I want to thank again and welcome her to a show again in the near future, Christine Bier from Paris. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
And Larry Freeman from Baltimore here, both of them from EIR, and both of them have special connections to Africa. Thanks again. This is Marcia Mary Baker, December 18th, 2010.